Thank you for coming to the official Washington launch of, you guessed it, Innovation Economics. My name is Bill Von William. I work with MIT. Let me just say that ITIF, for which Rob and Steve are laboring awards, has been at the forefront of trying to get Washington to think very differently about economic policies. In hundreds of reports and events over the last 6 years, Rob and Steve and their colleagues have made the case that innovation ought to be at the heart of economic policy, not something that we drift into by accident in spite of economic policy. You know, the parties in this town are still organized around old classical economics, the economics of labor supply and capital supply. What ITIF, and particularly this book, are attempting to do is change the thinking, to put innovation policy, what we could call technological and related innovation, at the forefront of economic policy and social and political policy. I've known Rob for many years. Before founding ITIF in 2006, he was a vice president of the Progressive Policy Institute. He was the first executive director of the Rhode Island Economic Policy Council. Before that, he worked at the famous Congressional Office of Technology Assessment, now gone, but a fabulous training ground for policy thinkers in this town. And he was at the forefront of it. He served on many high-level boards. Most recently, the White House has named him as co-chair of the U.S.-China Innovation Policy Experts Group. Rob earned his PhD from the University of North Carolina, and this is his third major book. His colleague and co-author is Steve Ezell, who's a senior analyst with ITIF. He co-founded Peer Insight, an information research and consulting firm. He conducted market research for NASDAQ. He's a graduate of Georgetown and at School of Foreign Service. Steve is one of those great rising policy thinkers that have come through this very interesting team at ITIF. He's a great leader there. Now I'd like to note that Rob and Steve will happily sign books at the cut rate price of $20 right after this program. So make sure you get some time before you have to leave to get their signatures on your own original copies. Let me turn to David Leonhardt. You know, his name is familiar, of course, to those of you, I hope everyone in the room reads the New York Times. He's the bureau chief for the Times. For a number of years, he wrote the paper's economic scene column, and there's been plenty to write about, the housing bubble, the economic downturn, the budget deficit, health reform, education. And in 2011, he won the Keep writing the economics you're writing, and you're going to be the Pulitzer Prize for his commentary. Obviously, the top honor in the journalism world. David has also been a staff writer for the Times Magazine. He won the Gerald Loeb Award for magazine writing in 2009 for a noted piece called Obama Economics, Obamanomics, as we phrase it. In 2005, he was one of the reporters who produced Class Matters, the paper's series on social class in the United States, a remarkable series. In addition, he founded an analytical sports column called Keeping Score. So you can ask David questions on that. He became Washington Bureau Chief for the Times in September 2011. Before joining the Times, he worked for Business Week and he worked for the Washington Post. And appropriately enough, he studied applied mathematics at Yale. He's a third-generation native of New York. David, welcome, and thank you for giving us your commentary.
Thank you for that nice introduction. If you ask me about sports, I will take up the rest of the session answering the questions, so be careful. I'm just going to talk for just a couple minutes and try to set the scene in the terms a little bit of our discussion. I'm going to turn over to these folks, and then we'll have a discussion, and we'll open it up for all of you as well. I'm, I was so happy to be asked to be a part of this because there is no more important subject to the future of this society than innovation, I would argue. There is nothing that can solve our problems in the way that strong economic growth could solve our problems, nothing. Think about nearly anything. Think about the health of your relatives. Economic growth gives us the resources to pay for a much better healthcare system. And more specifically than that, innovation is what creates that better healthcare system. If you have visited any number of types of medical clinics, and you think to yourself, what would this place have been like 20 or 50 or 100 years ago? There is an awe-inspiring and humbling series of conditions today. I assume you know someone or are related to someone who has one, most of us are, that we could not treat in anywhere near the way we can today. In some cases, we couldn't treat them at all. Visit a child leukemia ward, where the recovery rates are nowhere like 100%, unfortunately, but they're closer to 100 than they are at zero, and for a long time, they were much closer to zero. That's about innovation. When you think about much grander, less personal things, when you think about the United States rivalry with China and our ability to try to, this may not be the way one would phrase it, but project American values around the world, or at least try to prevent the democratic and human rights values that we see as important from being trampled on, economic growth makes that more possible because it not only turns the United States into a model that other people look to, but it allows the United States to pay for the diplomats and the military that can go around the world and try to make a difference. And this seems like a particularly important week to keep that in mind. For a long time, the United States has been the world's leader in innovation. By some metrics, we still are. If you go to China, you will listen to a lot of envy from leaders of Chinese society about how much they want to be like us. We think we want to be like them, but they really want to be like us. They want Google, they want the iPhone, they even want websites that they block. One of my favorite things was sitting with the top leader of the Communist Party and listening to him tell me how much they would like to have Facebook. And so the question is, how do we make that happen? And I just want to end my opening remarks on the what turned out tragically to be the final column of Peter David, who some of you may have known. He was a writer for The Economist. He wrote the Lex column. And he, in his final column, which I'm just going to read a couple lines from, referred to something called the binary illusion. He said, people tend to think in black and white. America is either in decline or is ordained to be forever the world's greatest nation. And I think it is in between those two poles where our discussion today is. It is in between the notion that we are destined to decline and the notion that we are destined forever to be on top of the world. It is the place where you say the United States may well remain the leader of the world economically and in terms of innovation, but it is not preordained. It is possible without being inevitable. And the only way to ensure that it will happen is through a series of strategies and in many cases changes to what we are doing today. And that's what this book is about. It's about diagnosing that problem and suggesting a solution. And with that, I turn it over to our authors.
All right, well, thank you, David. That's a wonderful framing and introduction. Thank you, Bill, for those introductions as well. Thank you all for coming today. So when we started to write this book, the inspiration for it was really in part from a lot of meetings that we were having over the last 5 or 6 years, both in this country and around the world, with foreign officials. And they were strikingly different than meetings we would have a decade ago. A decade ago, I remember sitting and talking to Europeans about how they were going to try to save their shipbuilding industry and their coal mining industry. And now, what we were hearing were very, very different discussions, not only in Europe, but Southeast Asia, even South America, Latin America, which was essentially, we want to talk to you about how our country can win in this new global innovation race. We want to attract, grow, and start up the highest value-added, most innovative firms in key industries, and we want to be able to get the jobs and the income that go with that. And we saw that and we said, you know, there's something different here that's changed over the last decade. There is what we ended up terming this global race for innovation advantage. And that's really what the book is about. It talks about how the U.S. has fallen behind in that race. It talks about what other countries are doing and what we need to do. And lastly, it talks about what are the political economy barriers, both in the U.S. and in other countries, that make innovation and innovation policy so hard. So that's what we're going to go through today. It really won't take as long as it looks. But really, you saw some numbers in here before about some of the troubling economic statistics that we're seeing today. And I think one of the questions that to us has not been really adequately answered is why? What is going on that makes those numbers so troubling? Clearly, there was a financial collapse. The dominant narrative is it takes a long time to recover from financial collapses. We've got to wait for housing prices to come back up to get people out of underwater. We've got to wait for the Europeans to solve their debt crisis, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's really missing the point. Clearly, the financial crisis was due to a housing bubble. The question is, why was there a housing bubble? And what we argue is there was a housing bubble because the well of real investment dried up in the United States. In other words, if you look at the 90s and compare to the 2000s, the demand for capital from Wall Street for real investment, for wealth creation investment, significantly declined. At the same time, there was a giant inflow of money, particularly from China, flooding the U.S. markets. And you had an enormous amount of capital looking for a home. And in this case, literally, it went into homes, which is a consumption item, not a production item. So let's go through a couple of quick statistics. So then we went from making things to making money. We went from making things to consuming things. This is a good example of that ratio of commercial to industrial and commercial to consumer loans. Used to be banks were in the business of making loans to companies who were going to create wealth. And they shifted out of that because it was easier to make money giving money to people to buy cars or homes that they ultimately couldn't pay them off. In the 90s, you can see that the blue line is the increase in investment in corporate investment in machinery and equipment and software, the core building blocks of growth, much bigger than housing. The first half of the 90s, you saw that big decline in investment, big ramp up in housing. Yeah, same thing. The last half of the 90s, 81% growth in real investment in the economy. In the 11 years since, just a 20% growth in real investment for the economy. Decline in venture capital. Decline in IPOs. One of the reasons for this is not that U.S. companies weren't investing. They were increasingly investing overseas, as Stephen will talk about, because other countries wanted that investment more than we wanted it. And they put in place the policies to attract that. Another example, major industrial relocations and plant expansions in the U.S. These are everything from a corporate headquarters to a factory to an R&D lab, fell by about half in that period of time. So again, the engine of companies establishing new plants and equipment and headquarters here declined. Big shift in corporate FDI, big growth in foreign direct investment outside the country, decline in inward foreign direct investment. And finally, perhaps the most dramatic change that happened was a really unprecedented fall off in U.S. manufacturing employment. It fell by a third. This was a faster rate of decline in manufacturing jobs than in the Great Depression. So you put all of that together, and to us, that suggests that the U.S. is facing an innovation and competitiveness crisis. And one of the results of that is big trade balances. So what's the cause of all of this? My colleague Stephen will focus on that and looking more in depth at that.
Good morning. So what's the cause of this decline in investment in the United States and the erosion of U.S. competitiveness and innovation capacity? Let's answer that question by rolling the tape back a bit to just after World War II, when the U.S. became a nationalized economy. What happened is that companies, which used to be tied to a home state, now leveraged the emergence of the interstate highway system, a national telecommunications network, jet travel, to expand their operations nationally across the country. Now, some states, particularly those in the South and West, responded with very aggressive economic development policies to try and attract that now national investment. One of the states dithered. And so you had the Rust Belt and the Sun Belt. Well, in the 2000s, that same process played out again, only this time on a global level. Now, with the emergence of undersea fiber optic cables, the World Wide Web, the internet, ocean freight, air travel, companies could locate their production activities anywhere in the world. So what fundamentally has happened is that nations have moved from being price makers to price takers in global marketplaces. What do I mean by that? Well, now multinational corporations in globally traded sectors like advanced manufacturing or life sciences now shop the world to find the best investment environment locations. So they will ask United States, United Kingdom, Canada, Germany, Japan, China, what do you have to offer us in terms of the best access to pools of skilled talent, the best digital and physical infrastructure, the best tax, regulatory, and immigration systems, the most robust investments in science and technology R&D to help us answer where we should locate our globally mobile production and R&D activities. So countries around the world responded with aggressive national innovation strategies. Government officials in these countries wake up every morning asking how they can do whatever it takes to attract and grow the highest value-added sectors of economic activity. As Greg Tassi at NIST has said, as a result of this, competition among governments has become a critical factor in determining global market share among nations. Now, countries have responded with a range of good and bad or ugly policies. The good policies are those like investing in education, investing in science and technology, reforming your tax, your immigration, your regulatory systems. This is why we look around the world and we see that at least 36 nations have now created national innovation strategies. They're not content to let disparate policies around education or trade or tax impact innovation in their country in a haphazard way. They create game plans to compete and win in the global race for innovation advantage. We see this particularly on the corporate tax side. You know, if you go back to the 1990s, U.S. corporate tax rates were roughly on par with all OECD countries. Today, we have the highest corporate tax rate in the OECD. And in fact, we are the only OECD country in which the statutory corporate tax rate has not declined over the past decade. We see this also in level of investment in research and development. From 1995 to 2008, U.S. R&D intensity, that's R&D as a share of GDP, increased by a paltry 10.4% in the United States. It increased double that rate in Germany, 65% in Finland, 135% in Singapore, and 170% in China. We're falling behind as a nation in investing in our future. We can see this in other areas too, like investing in industrial research. Great program we have in this country called the Manufacturing Extension Partnership supports the competitiveness of small manufacturing enterprises in our country. Japan invests 3 times more as a share of GDP in its counterpart program than we do. But it wasn't just that other countries were putting in place good policies. They were also putting in place bad and ugly ones. These types of policies, used by countries we call innovation mercantilists, are designed to win the race for global innovation advantage by manipulating and distorting global trade in order to boost their exports, reduce their imports, and induce the shift of intellectual property, technology, and production to their shores. These countries use an array of tools, such as currency manipulation, standards manipulation, IP theft, forced IP transfer, or forced local production as a condition of market access, in order to win. Now, we argue in the book that China is the world's foremost practitioner of these types of innovation mercantilist strategies. However, their apparent success has caused other countries like Argentina, Brazil, India, Russia to adopt similar tactics. And while some may argue that mercantilists only hurt themselves in the long run, the reality is that they can do serious damage to the U.S. economy. In fact, the International Trade Commission, in a 2011 study, found that intellectual property theft from China alone, in the year 2009 alone, cost the U.S. $48 billion in economic activity and 1 million jobs. The emergence of this, what we might call Beijing consensus, which has the attitude to engage the global trading system when it benefits you and game the system when you can, presents fundamentally a challenge to the longstanding Washington economic consensus, which holds that market-based trade and open markets are the way to maximize global innovation. But it's not just that other countries have put in place smart and effective policies to get more fit and trim, to get stronger, or that sometimes they use unfair tactics. It's also that we've tripped up and we've fallen behind. We fail to keep up our pace in the race for global innovation advantage, even as other countries have ratcheted up the competition. We see this in a number of areas. I talked about how we now have the highest corporate tax rate in the OECD. When you look at the generosity of our R&D tax credit, we created the system in 1981, had the highest tax credit as recently as 1992. Today we have the 27th most generous R&D tax credit in the world at a rate that's even less generous than that of Brazil, China, or India. We're stagnant in research funding. We're only 22nd in the world in terms of government funding for university research as a share of GDP. We have a counterproductive and ineffective high school immigration policy. We have a faltering education system. We rank 23rd among innovation-based economies in the PISA study of science education scores for American high school students. We have an inadequate physical infrastructure, $2.2 trillion deficit. We lag other nations in the deployment of advanced digital networks like intelligent transportation systems, the smart grid, or health IT. And we have a relatively increasing regulatory burden. So what's the implication of this? What does this all mean? Well, last year, a study came out from the Harvard Business School called Prosperity at Risk. What this study did was interview 10,000 Harvard Business School alumni, including 1,700 who, in the past year, in their capacity working for major multinational corporations, had been responsible for making investment location decisions, whether to put R&D centers or factories in the United States or in other countries. The study found that in 2/3 of those cases, the United States lost out. That's simply not good enough if we're going to remain a competitive economy and we're going to produce sufficient numbers of high-wage jobs for Americans to continue to enjoy the standard of living to which we've grown accustomed.
Okay, so let me just wrap up by saying, you know, we've gone through how the U.S. has failed in keeping up its ability to invest and how that led to the financial crisis and is leading and contributing to the very unprecedented malaise of the slow economic recovery, particularly on employment, and how other countries have stepped up their game. So what do we need to do about it? We essentially argue in the book for what we call the eight I's. I'm not going to go through all the eight I's, but one of the first and most important ones is insight. We need to really recognize that we are in competition, which, by the way, a number of leading economists and policymakers deny that core fact, Paul Krugman and Greg Mankiw being good examples on the right and the left, who say the U.S. doesn't compete with other countries. Boeing may compete with Airbus, but we don't compete with Europe or any other country. We really need to overcome that view, and we need to have a more realistic view. I appreciated David's point about this kind of really false debate we get into, that we're either generally in decline or we're number one and always will be number one. The only reason we've been number one is because we've worked at it, and the idea that we can have it as a birthright, I think, is a mistake. So we need insight into that. And then we talk about the three other major things, what we need to do. One is incentives. Stephen talked about the fact that our statutory corporate tax rate is so high. But in fact, our effective corporate tax rate is quite high, anywhere between 3rd to 7th, depending upon the study. One study recently found, an NBER study, recently found that multinationals in the U.S. pay the highest effective corporate taxes in the world. So we've got to focus on that. What we would argue would be not only a rate reduction, but a very significant investment incentive. Essentially, companies who agree to invest in new machinery and equipment, software, worker training, or R&D in the United States should be able to get a very significant tax incentive to make that more likely. Second is investment. You know, one of the reasons we became the dominant innovation player was that we were the dominant innovation funder. In the mid-1960s, the U.S. government alone invested more in research and science than the entire world combined. The entire world, private and public combined. When you get that much of a head start and a lead, you're going to be in the lead for a long, long time. But you've got to keep that up. And we have failed to keep that up. We failed to invest in, certainly in science, but also in core areas like education, training, and other kinds of infrastructure. And lastly, we can't win this race if other countries are manipulating the race. We've got to step up our game, but we also have to fight back against what we've called the Beijing consensus. The Beijing consensus now is spreading like a virus, if you will. Other countries are looking at the U.S. and going, this Washington consensus thing didn't seem to work out too well for you. How do we do what China's doing? In other words, how do we manipulate standards? How do we force companies to transfer technology, et cetera, et cetera? We need to step up that game, and we can't do it alone. We've got to form a significant alliance with our European colleagues, our Commonwealth nation colleagues, and anybody else who is committed to fundamentally the principles of market-based trade. So what's standing in the way of that? Why haven't we done this? It's not simply because people aren't always aware of it. I think there are significant both political and ideological hurdles that we face. I'm not going to talk about the political ones that are in the book. I just want to talk about the ideological ones. We argue in the book that the biggest hurdle and the most important thing we can do is transform what is essentially a failed Washington economic consensus that was established in the post-war era around Bretton Woods into a new innovation consensus. And what do we mean by that? There is this Washington economic consensus, which is essentially dominant, which is if you're not a member of that consensus, you don't get invited to Jackson Hole, certainly, and other prestigious events. But it really fundamentally doesn't work anymore. And there are a number of components to the Washington economic consensus. One of them is the U.S. is the dominant economy in the world, and we will be because we are market-based and we don't restrict entry and exit and we try to respect price signals. That's the core view. If you obey that set of rules, you automatically will win. And I think what we've seen is, no, we don't automatically win if we obey those rules. That's no longer enough to win this race. It's a necessary but insufficient condition. Another part of the Washington consensus, which is really deeply, deeply held, is we shouldn't really worry about those Chinese mercantilists or these emerging Indian mercantilists or the Brazilian mercantilists, because we all know that mercantilists only hurt themselves. The solution is markets. Markets always work. If you're a mercantilist, you're going to hurt yourself. You know, that may be true in the long run, but as Keynes said, in the long run, we're all dead. It's also has another major problem is mercantilists are sort of a joint suicide pact, if you will. They bring us down as well as themselves. And lastly, a deeply held component, is a wonderful line by Robert Solow, the Nobel Prize winning economist, who once stated, innovation is like manna from heaven. And what he meant by that is there's nothing public policy can do to spur innovation. It's sort of like background radiation. It just exists. It's constant. And it's just this thing that happens. Somebody invents an iPhone. Magic. And it really misses what almost every other country has figured out, is that innovation is a human construction, and that you can have an innovation system that is more supportive or less supportive. And if you have one that's less supportive, you will get less innovation. So what we need is a new Washington innovation consensus that recognizes that we're in competition, and if we don't act, we're going to continue to lose, that markets are a component of this, but that you need an active innovation policy. And the other thing I think that we see increasingly, we certainly see it in this election, one of the things that you see in other countries is that even where there are fairly significant splits between the right party and the left party in these parliamentary democracies, they're able to come together in common cause around innovation and competitiveness much more effectively than we are. And I understand that we're not going to have a common agreement on core hot-button issues like abortion or healthcare or some of these issues. But we really should be able to have common agreement on certain core issues around corporate tax reform, investing in R&D and the like. We see that in one example in the Senate right now, a bill called the Startup America 2.0. Wonderful bill, bipartisan support, Republican and Democrat. Would reform high-skill immigration, has a great R&D tax credit idea in there, and a number of other really good provisions. So there's progress, there's hope, I should say. We'll see whether Startup America passes in the Senate, and there's a House version as well. So there is hope. So at the end of the day, how do we get inspired to win? I think we can go back in history and think a little bit back. After World War II, this is a picture of Bretton Woods in New Hampshire. the U.S. really did take the lead. We were the ones that pulled together a troubled world and said, let's create a framework for how we're going to go forward. And we need to do the same today. And I'll close with remarks by this gentleman. If you haven't read George Kennan's new biography, I really encourage you to read it after you buy our book, of course. It's a really fantastic book. But Kennan wrote, obviously famous for writing what's called the Long Memo in 46 from Russia when he was posted there. And what he stated was, we should experience a certain gratitude to a providence by which providing the American people with this implacable challenge, in other words, fighting and winning the Cold War and defending freedom and democracy, has made their entire security as a nation dependent on their pulling themselves together and accepting the responsibilities of moral and political leadership that history plainly intended them to bear. And we did. We did because we had a generation of Americans who were willing to bear any price and fight any fight. We need to do the same today. We need to rally around that vision, only this time it's not really a Cold War we're fighting. This time it's about restoring U.S. innovation leadership and at the same time, as David alluded to, really restoring the ability, really restoring the vision of innovation and free markets around the world, with the U.S. being the leader of that. So with that, I'll stop and we'll turn it over to David. Do it here for a little bit.
Thank you both. Let me just start a little bit with some of the kind of background causes of where we are, and then we'll spend most of our time, I think, on the more of the solutions question. But two things. First of all, I assume that there's this whole debate about to what extent our problems are cyclical or structural, right? I think, but tell me if I'm wrong, that you're arguing that you're not arguing that they're not cyclical, but you're arguing that to a substantial extent they are structural as well, right? I mean, when I kind of look at the data and I look at the massive fall off in consumer spending, it's not just housing, right? It's cars, it's appliances, it's all these things. I mean, it seems clear to me that we had a huge bubble, right? That it popped, and that much of our problem with a high unemployment rate today doesn't stem from things like education. But it stems from these cyclical factors. And then laid on top of that are these really worrisome structural factors. The fact that we don't have enough highly skilled workers, so the unemployment rate for college graduates is 4%, and for everyone else, what is it, 9%, right? And so that is a confluence between the two. And I understand why you spend more time on structural factors, because that's really what you're thinking about. And in the long term, I think you can make a really strong case it's more important. But do you agree that cyclical factors are also really important right now, or would you put it differently from the way I just did?
No, I think we'd say that that's accurate, although we might put the emphasis allocate the emphasis slightly differently. I think there are a number of core arguments we're trying to make in the book. One of them is that we really miss the point if we look at the financial collapse as simply this Wall Street-enabled CDO kinds of thing. Fundamentally, Wall Street collapse happened because mortgages couldn't be paid off, and somebody was going to pay a price, and it just ended up getting redistributed what the price was. And at the time, nobody believed that you could have a nationwide real estate collapse, which is another thing we point out in the book, that it should have been pretty obvious if you just look at historical case Shiller. Historical case Shiller was you know, price was way above it. So I think that the current malaise is related to, but not only, this. So Dean Baker has written a response to our book where Dean has argued that structural factors have nothing to do with it, and it's, if we just did a $2 trillion stimulus now, everything would be good. Well, first of all, the reality is we can't do a $2 trillion stimulus because our structural problems got us into debt. And so we're playing from a hand, not a full hand at this point. And a couple other structural factors, I think, that are contributing to the cyclical one. One is that we still have a lot of leakage. So even when we did the stimulus, a lot of it leaked out. So we got a less of a Keynesian multiplier because you had a trade leakage. Secondly, there is some evidence that we have educational mismatches in certainly some parts of the job. We'd have faster employment recovery if we had fewer educational mismatches, which is something we should have addressed long ago. And the last point is a little bit more nuanced, and that is, if somehow, if you remember Men in Black, you know, where Will Smith, you know, he holds up this thing, you know, the neuralizer, and he clicks the thing, and you forget everything you've heard. If President Obama could hold up a national neuralizer and tell everybody, you now will believe 100% that America will dominate the world in innovation and competitiveness and manufacturing in 5 years, I think the dynamic, the Keynesian animal spirits would revive somewhat. So it's I think part of the problem is that our Keynesian animal spirits, we sort of feel insecure. We feel like, I don't know whether we're going to win in the future, so I'm going to hold back. And I think companies are holding back. I think individuals are holding back. So anyway, long way of saying, David, I don't disagree that there are certainly cyclical factors, but they're combined with structural.
If I might just add a brief addition to that response. You know, the way I see it is if you look at how the U.S. has tried to drive its economy going back 15 years, it's about constantly resorting to artificial shots to the heart to try and revitalize and re-stimulate the economy. So whether you're looking at the low interest rates under Greenspan that was trying to restore the economy after you had the bubble, or even the stimulus package today, right, which is just different sides of the same coin ultimately trying to artificially pump up the heart, well, what other countries like Germany do is that they're constantly trying to build the heart muscle. They're constantly trying to increase their capacity to compete and to innovate. And we argue that's where the focus of our economic policy has got to be long term.
No, that's a nice analogy. And I guess the two things I would add to that is it does seem to me those artificial shocks have played an extremely important role, right? I mean, if you look at Barry Eichengreen, who's an economist out in California, and a colleague, I apologize to that colleague whose name I'm not remembering, have done these incredible charts to me on VoxEU in which they compare a series of global economic measures, global trade, world stock prices, industrial production, and they set the starting date to 1929 and to September 2008. And the fall off in those all those things look remarkably similar in their severity between those two periods. The difference is in 1930, they just keep falling. And in early 2009, thanks to some combination of the Fed, the Obama administration, and the final months of the Bush administration, they don't keep falling, right? And it seems to me those shocks to the heart are a big reason for that. Although I agree with you, I mean, I think they were necessary but not sufficient, right? And to me, and I'm not asking you this because I'm not asking you to defend the cyclical argument, but the thing I've never heard the people who make the cyclical argument explain in any satisfying way is, if it's all cyclical, how is the unemployment rate in a highly educated metro area like the one we're sitting in 6%? How is it 6% in Boston? How is it 6% in Minnesota? And then you look at places that are far less skilled and have far, far fewer advantages, and it's much higher.
One other quick point, David. I think one of the things about the great... First of all, look, we embrace Keynesianism, and we're not anti-Keynesian. Keynesianism has a role. Counter-cyclical policy has a critical role to play, although we actually... think we could sort of do more innovation Keynesianism, which is one of the reasons why we did push for things like investments in science and infrastructure in the stimulus package, because you get a double hit. You build up the heart muscle and you get the insulin. But I do think one of the differences between the Great Depression, besides a terrible fiscal policy back then, is we were poised for this enormous recovery after that to be the dominant world leader. And so that's not where we're poised today. And that was a big difference.
Let me make sure I understand one thing. In one part of your presentation, it seems to me you talk about how there is essentially too much demand for capital, I think. And in one place it seems like you're talking about there's not enough capital, and in another it seems like you're saying there's too much capital. And I think actually they're consistent, but I didn't get it, so I'm thinking maybe someone else didn't. So at one point you talk about the notion that essentially capital had no place to go during the last decade because there weren't any compelling investments. So it went into housing, which we all know the results of that. But then you also point out how weak our R&D funding has been. Can you help me fit those two pieces together? Because in one case, it sounds like you're saying there's too much money, and in another, it sounds like you're saying there's not enough.
Yeah. Well, I think what we think is part of the problem with the debate is if you look at the left side of the economic debate, Keynesians will say it's all about consumer demand. If you look at the right side, really supply-siders, they'll say it's all about the supply of capital. And I think our framework is different. It's really about the demand for capital. That's what drives an economy. We don't have problems with capital supply in any macro sense. We might have allocation problems. R&D is different. It's not really capital in the sense of... you know, there's a massive capital out there one could borrow if one wanted to borrow it in global markets. R&D is different because R&D, particularly on the public side, is a targeted investment where we basically say to each other, we're all going to consume a little less this year so that our children can do better in the future. And that's really what R&D investment is. It's just we're giving up something today for something tomorrow. And that's one of the things we talk about in the book, that we argue that the United States has essentially become a me now society, and other countries are much more about we then. And in a me now society, you don't want to invest in a lot of R&D because I get no benefit from an R&D investment this year. So I think that's
good. And many people who make the investment will get only scant benefit ever, right?
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, and another point, which I think the Washington Consensus misses, is there very, very clear evidence from scholars, which we review in the book, that corporate R&D, companies that invest in R&D don't get all the benefits. At best, they get half of the benefits.
I knew I'd find a way to get sports into this. My favorite example of this is, I don't know if any of you know who Dan Okrent is, but Dan is a longtime editor and writer at Time. He was the New York Times' first public editor. He's the inventor of rotisserie baseball. It's called rotisserie baseball because Dan and a group of colleagues of his at Time Inc. invented it at a restaurant in New York called, is it Bleu or La Rotisserie? I don't think Dan has made a cent from rotisserie baseball, right? And yet it's something that has brought enjoyment, I mean, thousands of hours of enjoyment, yeah. Right? And that's just sort of one little example, right? They're obviously more important examples.
Maybe we need an NSF program for sports
yes.
innovation.
Let's talk for a minute about the deficit. I assume you guys would agree the budget deficit is a big problem. There are also a lot of agenda items on this list of stuff that we should do that would add to the deficit, right? Cutting corporate taxes. Not only that, but not simplifying the tax rate. You're talking about cutting the rate and also expanding one of the tax rates. Increasing spending on R&D, increasing spending on infrastructure. So where from an innovation perspective, how do you think we should solve our deficit problem?
Yeah, I mean, a good example, I think, in history is you go back and you look at, as we do in the book, look at Finland. Back in 91, when the Soviet Union was breaking up, Finnish economy was essentially just an appendage of the Soviet Union economy, and their economy went into freefall collapse, twice as much of an economic collapse as a share of GDP than the U.S. did. They were running major budget deficits. So what did they do? First thing they did is they cut their corporate tax rate by, 35%. Then they cut it again. Second thing they did is they massively increased their investment in science and R&D. And then they cut spending. So I see this debate we have in the U.S. as really a false debate. We have to increase more investment, and including, if you would, a corporate tax expenditures being a public investment, if you will. There are lots of ways we could, and we take the budget deficit very seriously in the book. We've got to ultimately fix it if it can't go on, Herbstein, if it can't go on forever, it won't. But the way we should do it, we argue, is you really have to focus on entitlements. I don't know if we get into this in the book, but we would take the radical position of you got to make older people work a lot longer. I mean, that's the only way to solve this problem in the medium term. You got to raise the retirement age significantly. You've got to cut early retirements and federal government and incentives in the corporate sector to do that. Because those are just people who are just consuming without producing and raising costs. The second thing we do have to raise revenues. And so I think our view is, so the left, it doesn't want to do that. I think one of the mistakes of the right is, we would argue there's very little evidence that going back to a 39% marginal tax rate or eliminating the dividend cuts that were in the first term of the second Bush administration. The evidence on the dividend cuts, which is very interesting, the scholarly evidence on the dividend tax cut where it took dividends down from normal income down to 10%, was that what it really did is it basically meant corporations paid out more dividends. And if you look at the ratio of capital investment to dividends, right after that, it went way, way down. So companies used to retain capital, reinvest it. Now they're giving it back more to shareholders. Again, this kind of me now thing. So you could do that. You could raise certain taxes. We argue in the book also that it would be very good to have a carbon tax. You could raise a lot of money with a carbon tax. There are other kinds of taxes we could raise as well. So I would eliminate the whole mortgage deduction. I think that would be wonderful public policy and use the... $90 billion on that, and a lot of money for that. So, absolutely, I think what you want to do is you don't want to make our internationally mobile factors of production any less competitive than they already are.
Having just bought a house, I cannot tell you the extent of the struggle Rob and I had about getting that point, about eliminating the mortgage tax deduction into the book.
Grandfathered.
But I'd also, you know, say to that, while we do have to raise income and cut spending, the simple reality is that we can, you know, raise all the income we can and cut all the spending we can, we're not going to close the budget deficit. The only way we're going to get there is through economic growth. And Rob, I think you'll help me remember the stat from the three deficits paper, but we say that if we are able to raise economic growth by 1% a year over a decade, we'll be able to cut out several billion dollars from the
certainly a lot of, yeah. I mean, so I should have, actually should have said that, David, that another component that we have to put on the table is growth. I mean, growth does help, and I think if you adopted these policies, you would certainly spur growth, and that would contribute.
The reality of the defense is that when you have a $6.2 trillion trade deficit with the rest of the world since 2000, when you actually run a $100 billion a year trade deficit in advanced technology products, in the high-end ICT, manufacturing, life sciences technologies, which we're supposed to lead the world in, that's a sign that we're not generating as much economic growth as we should, maybe more.
I mean, my reading of the history of closing of deficits is that growth has been the most common way to do it, right? The problem is it's also the most uncertain, right? If we raise the Medicare retirement age to 67, we could be certain it would have a huge impact on the deficit, right? If we took tax rates on high earners even one-fifth of the way back toward their long-term historical average, it would have a huge impact on the deficit. If we raise the growth rate by a half percentage point, a quarter percentage point a year, it would likewise have a huge percent, but we don't know exactly where that dial is or when we turn the kind of things you're talking about, when it kicks in, right?
Yeah, and I think it's a little bit more than that, though. I think we know a lot more than we think, and again, this is where we in the book would take issue with what is essentially the dominant neoclassical economics framework. Paul Krugman once was quoted as saying, productivity is the most important thing in an economy, but economists know nothing about it, therefore the rest of my book will talk about other issues. Alan Blinder was quoted a while back saying, there is nothing, repeat, absolutely nothing that economists know that can raise the rate of GDP growth one percentage point. That is a pretty stark statement. So the most important thing you want from your economist class is to how do you figure out how to raise your GDP rate, and they admit that they know nothing how to do that. Now, there is this whole emergent field in the last decade of what is called endogenous growth theory or new growth or innovation economics or whatever you want to call it, where a lot of economists are just studying that question, how do you get the half a percent or 1%? I think we need to be a little more optimistic that we do know more than we think, and that, you know, I'll give you an example. A wonderful study by Larry Summers back in 1979 with Alan Auerbach, and This was a very influential study that ended up shaping the 1986 tax reform to eliminate the investment tax credit. But Larry Summers and Auerbach did essentially a DRI model of the economy, modeled with an investment tax credit and modeled without. What they found was that an economy with an investment tax credit for machinery and equipment outperformed an economy without it. You had higher machinery, you had higher investment, and you had higher GDP growth. So of course their argument was we should eliminate the investment tax credit, which is what we ended up doing. So they did that because they didn't think it was appropriate for government policy to allocate investment capital in any way other than what the market would do, even though we have housing subsidies. So I do think there are things we know.
Just 1 minute on corporate taxes. You talked about how we have one of the higher rates in the world. If you look at corporate taxes, the share of GDP in this country is way, way down, right? Richard Clarida, Columbia economist, former Bush advisor, has said that the dirty little secret about corporate taxes is that they used to raise a lot of money and they don't anymore. How do you fit those two things in together, the idea that corporate taxes raise much less money than they used to? That's not the statutory rate, right? That's effective. And yet you see the effective rate is quite high.
So I apologize. There was a colleague of mine who does wonderful work. I think he's with PwC, and he's a tax expert. His analysis, which I think is quite convincing, is that almost all of that is switching out of corporate form. that what happened, particularly after 86, was it became easier and better financially to shift from C-corps to other kinds of S-corps and other things like that. And that's really why you saw the C-corp tax revenues go down. It wasn't that C-corps were paying less, it was just that there were fewer of them. So I think that's part of it. Again, if you look at our incentives themselves, they really haven't gotten any more generous. In fact, the 86 Tax Reform Act raised taxes on corporations and lowered them on individuals, exactly the opposite thing of what you need to do. The R&D credit has gotten a tad more generous, but expensing is about the same. So there may be other loopholes going on, which, you know, and we're not opposed to getting rid of loopholes.
What do you think of the argument some folks at the Tax Policy Center raised this, of just eliminating the corporate tax? You take the investment taxes, like capital gains and dividends, you bring them back up to ordinary income, and you just completely get rid of the corporate tax. And to quote Mitt Romney, you would say that corporations are people, right? And you tax the people, not the corporations.
Yeah, I actually do think corporations are people, and you know, corporate money ultimately, if it stays with the corporation, it's being invested or it's just sitting there, and it ends up flowing to individuals, and that's where you know. In theory, that works only if you believe, as the neoclassical economists believe, that the pre-tax marketplace is completely efficient. And we don't, nor does a lot of the growth economics literature. And a good example of that, which we found in the book to our surprise, there's a pretty long and dominant chain of evidence from the scholarly community that companies will underinvest in R&D without an incentive. That's why we have the R&D tax credit, because of they only get about half the benefit. Pardon?
The Okrent problem. Innovators don't get
it. Innovators don't get it, so they do less of it. If you look at the sort of the cost of capital and the societal rate of return, companies in the U.S. should be investing about $600 billion in R&D instead of $300 billion. That's the societally optimal rate of investment, and they don't. So that's one of the reasons why we have an R&D credit. It turns out that there's an awful lot of literature, again, in the last 10 years that says companies actually don't get all the investments when they invest in a new piece of software or a new machine tool. They do get it when they invest when they build a building or when they buy a vehicle. But when they invest in machinery equipment, they actually get about half of those benefits, and they spill over. And I won't go into the details how, but it turns out they spill over. So that's where I do think if you have a corporate tax code that, you know, really does lower the rate but keeps some core incentives in there. Another great example is workforce training. U.S. companies invest half in workforce training as they did a decade ago. And again, same thing, spillover effects. We all know that if you had a better trained workforce, you'd have higher GDP growth. Every other company would be better off because their talent pool is better. But for one company to bear that burden when workforce tenure rates have gone down, when their short-term pressures for profits have gone up. So I do think there's some core components where we want incentives to shape corporate behavior. There's a lot of stupid incentives. I don't get me wrong. I mean, you should jettison those. But some core ones, I think, still work, are needed.
One last thing before we open it up to everyone here. I know that you are more economic experts than political experts. But one of the important things about this book and your work is that it recognizes that you can't separate the two, right? And so I guess one thing I'd like to hear each of you talk about is, it seems to me there is an asymmetry between the parties here, right? And that behind the phrase partisan gridlock, there are some more specifics. And you can phrase it positively about either party. You can say the Republicans are more principled, and you can say the Democrats are more open to compromise. But there is a difference between the two, right? To take your two solutions, President Obama's not going to campaign on it, but he made clear during the debt talks that he is open to and would take the retirement age higher. He would do all sorts of things that would, I think, make many liberals very angry, right? But he essentially got Reid and Pelosi to come on, as best as we can tell. Republicans are much more opposed to tax increases than the people running the Democratic Party are to benefit cuts. Right, there are wings in each party that are similarly opposed, but the people running the Democratic Party are more open to benefit cuts than the people running the Republican Party are to tax increases. It's hard to see how anything resembling a tax increase, maybe more than, you know, $20, $30 billion a year, gets through a Republican House. So given that, what is the sort of long-term solution to a deficit? Do we just have to wait until one party wins and imposes its vision? Or do you see something that could change that gets rid of that asymmetry?
Well, I agree with you, there is asymmetry. I think the asymmetry probably was
180 degrees opposite 15 years ago.
I agree.
And now
and Clinton sort of switched.
Yeah,
right.
And now you have much more stridency on the sort of Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, which we think is unfortunate. Again, you go and look at all these other countries around the world who are doing a good job. What I think one of the things that distinguishes them is the ability for both sides of the political parties to get together around a common vision of making their countries winners. And so I don't see a big solution to that in any time soon. Therefore, I don't see a big solution to... our colleague Ed Luce wrote a wonderful book. I think, did you review it?
I did not,
okay.
But I agree.
Maybe it was somebody in the New York Times who had this quip again. Ed's book is called Time to Start Thinking, and it's about American problems in the economy. And somebody, a reviewer, quipped it should be called Time to Start Drinking. And if you've ever seen the movie Airplane, I think after you read our book, you'll say it's time to start sniffing glue. So in some sense, we're not optimistic because of the political economy challenges. But the one area I think that where there could be hope is what we've seen in the last few years is that there are corporate leaders who are stepping up to the plate and calling out this challenge. Paul Otellini at Intel, John Lechleiter at Eli Lilly, obviously Jeff Imholt, and others. And I think that's something different. And I'm hopeful that the corporate community will continue to speak out and really hold both parties accountable for making us move forward. I think that's our best hope.
Can we open it up?
Sure.
Do you want me to?
Yes, please, while you're looking around.
I would just add to that this morning we actually released a new report that compares the candidates' science, technology, and innovation policies. So it's a great side-by-side comparison on where they stand on a lot of these issues. We talk in the book and elsewhere about what we call the four T's that we have to get right as a country. That's technology, tax, trade, and talent. I think if you look at the four T's, you can actually find a fair degree of at least understanding between the two parties that these are things we have to address. We all know our education system is falling behind. We got to get it stronger. We got to reform our immigration system. We have to go into new global markets, but we also have to insist that our partners meet their trading commitments. So there's alignment on a number of important issues, and I think one of the best things we could do is understand that while bringing our fiscal crisis, our debt crisis into line, is vitally important. More important than that is, in fact, economic growth. Our countrymen are suffering. We have an unemployment rate greater than 8%. And whoever wins in November, if they don't solve these problems, they're going to be out of office again in 4 years. So there is an understanding on both sides, I think, to some degree, of what the problems are. And there should be common cause to find solutions to the problems afflicting our countrymen.
So I'm going to use my prerogative here to ask the first question, and then I want all of you to start thinking about what's going to be on the menu. You painted a picture here of this, potential breeze of innovation thinking coming into, and I liked David's phrase, partisan gridlock atmosphere in Washington. You've given us a picture of the battle between failing economic approaches around a Beijing consensus and the historic Washington consensus, arguing for an innovation consensus. And in a way, what you're telling us is that in our economic thinking, there's an innovation deficit, that if we have a set of very deep economic problems that have been triggered by a cyclical problem, our inability to climb out of those is profoundly related to a structural problem around this innovation deficit. I wonder if you could just paint, what's the menu? What are the critical items on that innovation deficit problem solving that we need to kind of go through? What are the handfuls of policy approaches? Obviously, you've been talking about R&D, but flesh this out a little bit for us, because after all, this is innovation economics that we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, the book does actually go through with a fairly specific laundry list of actionable policy ideas that we would love to see implemented, obviously. And so some of them are things like expanding federal support for science, but really also having a much more systemic effort in the country around commercialization. We have a happenstance system of commercializing that science. We need to have a serious program of getting it out to companies. We need a national manufacturing strategy, and I applaud the administration for their proposal for a thing called NNMI, National Network of Manufacturing Institutes. We've got to do things like that. We need to be rethinking our skills training system in the country. One of the reasons the Germans do well, not the only one, is they have a very robust apprenticeship program that links their skilled needs to very high-level apprenticeship programs. We can do something similar to that. It'd have to be kind of an Americanized model, but we could do that. Again, tax policy, I think, you know, having the 27th worst R&D tax credit in the world is a real problem. We should be able to do things there. Ideas like that. There's no shortage of ideas, really. And that's one of the, I think, the arguments we make in the book is it's not a surfeit of ideas that's the problem. It's a surfeit of understanding and political will.
As John Maynard Keynes said, the problem lies not in coming up with the new ideas, but in letting go of the old ones.
And it's all in the execution.
I do think there is an important question of what the public believes on one particular issue, which is education. I think there is a sort of, I'm guessing there isn't much of one in this room, but there is a surprising vein of skepticism about education, whether education is really worth it in the country today. You see it, I mean, it's the current cover of Newsweek. You see it in popular culture. There's a Kanye West song that essentially argues you're better off dropping out of college because he did and he succeeded. And I think that matters because I think it affects people's behavior. I think that if you hear enough, and this is something that really does come from both the left and the right, maybe a little bit more from the left, but it comes from both. If enough people hear college isn't worth it anymore, it's not a good investment, education doesn't pay off, that really is going to affect people's behavior. And when you look at the evidence, I think it's really hard to have an innovative, economically healthy society unless you're constantly increasing skills, right? There was a time in which high school was seen as the new frontier of education, and some people argued, why would we waste high school on everyone, right? And this was sort of a debate between the US and Europe. The US decided to waste high school on everyone. In retrospect, it looks like a pretty good decision, right? And so now that we've gotten there, what's to say 13 years is the new sort of natural limit of education? And so if you kind of think about that, I think when you think about kind of what should be on an innovation agenda, I think trying to come to some national consensus about whether education is really worth it matters, because the typical individual doesn't decide whether to invest in an R&D lab, but the typical individual does decide whether to invest in their kids' education.
You know, I agree with that, David. I think it's a little more complicated in this sense. One of the studies we cite in the book was an economist who did a very nice model, basically saying you can, the dominant neoclassical view of an economy is you have one equilibrium, you have demand and supply, and it comes to one point. And therefore, just leave it up to the market, it'll get you to that optimal point. What I think the better literature shows is you can actually have multiple equilibria. And he argues, as one economist argues, you can have essentially a low-skill, low-wage equilibria and a high-skill, high-wage. And the reason you can do that is because if workers don't feel like there are enough jobs that require them to get a good education, whether it's a technician education or a higher end, they won't get the education. And then if companies don't feel they have enough of the high skill, they won't restructure work around high skills. And so you end up in this poverty trap. And so you have to focus on education, but at the same time, you have to focus on the supply side and on the demand side. So one of the reasons I think people are a little frustrated with education is that the demand side has not held its own. And part of the reason the demand side hasn't held its own is because the supply side hasn't held its own. So it's only by intervening collectively that you work both together, I think.
Feel necessary and sufficient.
Yeah. So why don't we just open
it? Yeah, let me just say that. Let's get to you. Let's hear what your concerns are on your question.
Yeah, Joel Gutton, IRO Strategies. You kind of answered part of the way, I think, my question. I mean, the emphasis seems to be very what I call innovation push, but it seems that you can't, you know, you may have a lot of investments, like the government and policy should support innovation, but let the markets dictate the demand side, or are you also suggesting that we need to have a demand side investment strategy, like an infrastructure and other things to help drive, to help support and drive the innovation and see them working together. I'm just wondering if that's in your opinion.
You know, a little bit. I think the fact that we would not argue that overall Keynesian levels, macro demand, are the big driver anymore. Those that comes about from having a successful innovation and competitiveness system. Where I think demand can play a role, and we talk about this in a number of countries, is using government as a smart buyer. So there are things government is doing inherently that they could do better and smarter that would enable innovation. The British are doing this, for example, where they're restructuring their procurement so that they're less focused on prescriptive standards of what it is they want and more open on performance standards. So I think there are things like that government could clearly do there. Another area we talk about in the book a lot is institutional innovation. Again, I think, David, your point about education, I don't think we can solve the education problem with money. I think we've got to solve it with institutional innovation, new ways of doing things. So again, that's a way to induce innovation. If you have institutions that are set up to receive it and want it and demand it, then you'll get more of it.
Let me keep going with some more questions.
Mike Nelson with Bloomberg Government and also at Georgetown. This is a great book. I really appreciate it. It comes out at just the right time because I'm teaching a class on it.
Thanks,
so
Mike.
You sold 20 copies already. 5 cents. But I haven't had a chance to read the whole book yet, but I did what every Washingtonian does. I opened it and looked at the table at the index in the back. I wasn't looking for my own name. I wasn't looking for my favorite topics. I was looking for what was left out. And I noticed that the words open source, patent trolls, patent reform, SOPA, Linux, all these words weren't in there. There was seems to be no discussion of how the sharing economy is helping innovation, and how things like the World Wide Web, which was open standards, open source, has enabled innovation around the world. Instead, I see a lot of focus on why we need more intellectual property, and I don't see places where you discuss what happens to people let intellectual property out of the common good.
That's on page 419.
Left on the cutting room floor.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Mike, part of you just, you know, full disclosure, although it's not in the book, so you can still buy the book. We actually were supporters of a version of PIPA-SOPA. Not sure I like the final version, but we do think that that's important. At the same time, you know, I don't think that's antithetical. There are certain components of the IT system that are going to be open, that are going to be voluntary and open and interoperable standards, which is great. But it's just not something that we've focused on in any serious way in the book. I think the bigger challenge, frankly, to the U.S. is from other countries is piracy, not sort of the threat of openness. I think that's the bigger challenge for us. I mean, our country specializes in stuff that's intangible. If we only made, you know, widgets, it's hard to steal widgets. But it's easy to steal the intangible part of that. And that's what other countries are able to do much more easily. And that's our sweet spot. So I think so that's why we focus more on that. But I don't disagree with
you. But if every startup has to hire an intellectual property attorney as their fourth employee just to avoid lawsuits from all the big companies and the patent trolls, I think we've got a huge barrier to innovation.
Well, look, part of the reason we didn't put it in the book is that I do think the patent reform bill actually went a long way in that direction. It's not perfect, but it certainly addressed that. So in part, it's not an issue. The patent reform is not an issue that's going to come back for another 3 or 4 years at minimum. So I do think patent reform moved us somewhat in the right direction there.
I mean, a related point there to keep in mind is that while there are many forms of innovation that, if they don't happen in this country, people in this country will not benefit nearly as much from them, right? Because they need to be employed in this country. But there are also forms of innovation that it doesn't matter where they happen to benefit us, right? I'm cribbing here from a writer named Matt Iglesias. It's late, but I talked about childhood leukemia, right? If someone cures a form of cancer, it doesn't matter where that comes from, right? It will improve our lives. And so there are ways in which we're competing with other countries. There's also ways in which we benefit from their innovation.
Yeah, absolutely. And David, that's a critical point. It's so easy to fall into this, you know, black and white dichotomy on this. In the last chapter of the book, we talk about how one of the challenges we face in the world, we've got to build an innovation system that gets people moving into solving big global collective challenges where, you know, I want the Chinese to cure leukemia. I want the Indians to come up with a great, great battery. That ultimately helps us. But we've got to make sure that we're competing as well. If we're just letting other people do all the innovation, that's why we're really talking about that good competition is really win-win. If they ratchet up their science program, we ratchet up ours. It's the bad competition that's the problem.
Yes. You, yeah.
If I may, thank you so much for the testimony. But 2 weeks ago, I was in China chairing the first part of the First World Congress for Culture and Creative Industries. First remark, most of the most innovative presentations, creative presentations, were given by Americans. The only comprehensive source to identify which jobs can be created in very job-intensive culture creative industries where American presentations, American knowledge. And my question is, I have not read yet, but you addressed by the answer in your proposal the issue of knowledge economy, intangible. Is the Chinese, those advising the government were telling me, we are now looking for a policy approach to empower the development of knowledge-based economy in culture and creative industries.
Sure.
They were learning from the Americans.
Okay. Stephen, you want to do that? Or I'll do it. Okay. So, again, in the last chapter of the book, we have this sort of prospective view of what's the state of innovation-based competitiveness in major regions around the country, around the world. And the Chinese have a real problem. The Chinese essentially are, I don't mean it in a derogatory sense, but the Chinese fundamentally are copiers. The Chinese educational system, the Chinese state system is not designed for individual initiative, risk-taking, and creativity. Now, the Chinese realizes the problem, but fundamentally they're between a rock and a hard place, because if they want to get that, they really have to fundamentally transform their entire system, which means they've got to move away from a state dictatorship communist country. So I don't think the Chinese, I'm not worried about the Chinese winning on the creative side, but where the Chinese are very, very good at is engineering-based innovation. Chinese are very good at that because they got a lot of engineers, many of them are quite good, and they don't cost a lot, so you can put three of them on a problem. So that's a big challenge to our country. I mean, we are really great at science-based innovation. I still think we're the best country in the world at science-based innovation, the MITs of the world. You cannot be a good country unless you're also good at engineering-based innovation. You've got to be able to take that, you've got to be able to make high-value-added products. So Chinese have, it's almost, I hate to use the term yin and yang here, a little bit of a yin and yang. The Chinese are good at one component that we'd like to be good at, we're good at one component that they'd like to be good at.
And also, just briefly, one other point on China, that something you said in the beginning, David, which was you're talking to Chinese officials, and they were like, how can we get our own Facebook? And, you know, that kind of reflects a problem we see with the Chinese model in that, you know, the fundamental principle of the global trading system is based upon comparative advantage. The nations specialize in the things they do best, and we trade, and the process of trade, you know, creates maximum global growth for the entire world. We believe that China fundamentally rejects that model. They want absolute advantage in any number of high-tech industries, and you look at their 12th, you know, five-year plan, it's like 400 industries that they, you know, want absolute advantage in the world in. So, you know, I think this is one place where we have to move an understanding that if you want to engage in this global trading system, then, you know, you really, you know, embrace market-based global trade and don't try and feel like you have to pick off every single high-tech industry in the world.
Yes, in fact. So I actually don't think corporations have a responsibility to do very much of anything other than obey the law. And I don't mean to be flip about that, but I think we don't live in a world anymore where we can have
serious pressure like that on corporations. Again, we've moved from a price maker to a price taker model, and you know, if we impose restrictions on companies, they'll just go somewhere else. I think rather than impose restrictions or you know, regulatory rules about that, the only way we can change in behavior is really around a set of incentives. And so I would say one of the reasons we propose having the R&D tax credit expand to a knowledge credit to include training expenditures, that would give companies an incentive to do that. And I think also restructuring our training systems much more around industry-led, or in the case where there's unions, industry union-led training efforts, that would to me be much more effective. The last point, I think one of the mistakes we make in this country is we hold out skills as the panacea, as if all of our problems are through to skill deficits. And I think that's it's partly because I think companies want to get off the hook. Again, there's a wonderful business roundtable study we quote in the book where they put together a CFO panel around, I believe, 400 CFOs from major corporations, and they asked them, how many of you would be willing to cut research and development this quarter to meet your earnings targets? And I believe over 80% of them were willing to do that. That is not what most CFOs in Austria will do, or Germany will do, or Japan will do. And I think we've got to recognize that the capital markets have really shifted our investment strategy and our tax policies. And I don't think we can just sort of let companies off the hook by saying, if we just give you a pool of skilled workers, you'll start investing in America again. It's necessary. It's a component. It goes to this necessary but not sufficient argument.
Question right here.
Sure. I wanted to jump in on maybe a reason that this isn't the time to start drinking, and suggest that we actually have a really interesting case study currently of great success in this space, and that would be the auto recovery. And many of us are focused on what that means for jobs, but it's also been a transformative success in terms of rebuilding a supply chain that is not the old auto industry coming back, but a transformed industry, one that has delivered not only somewhere in the realm of 20% of GDP growth in the first two quarters of this year, despite being only 3% of the economy, but where we're seeing reinvestment in engineering, in R&D, not just from our local companies, but domestic investment by foreign automakers, by the entire supply chain. And so I just would throw out there, it's a question. What we're seeing, I think, there is a combination of both very good policy on the manufacturing side and some of the incentives both at the state and federal level, but we're also seeing an alignment of a regulatory alignment that gives long-term technology-driving signals and certainty to industry that align them with global demand. And I think that provides a place for our companies and foreign companies manufactured here to serve not some temporary opportunity, but a long-term growth opportunity globally. So I just would throw that out there, and I'm also sort of surprised that one of the words that hasn't come up in this conversation.
Well, I think... after watching both conventions, obviously the auto bailout is this, critical thing. Yeah, look, the auto bailout in our view was necessary and it helped, but I think we've got to remember how far down the U.S. auto industry has come in a very short time. And there's certainly pockets of strength. There's some companies that are stronger than others, and there's certainly been a rebound. I though would argue that a lot of that rebound is just simply a cycle, that's the durable goods in downturns tend to contract more than non-durables, and then when they come back, they tend to come back faster. But if you look at the recovery of manufacturing jobs overall, which I know autos have done better, but overall manufacturing jobs recovery is the worst we've ever had in a recession since 1970. So we all hear about how fast manufacturing is coming back. As a share of the loss from the peak of the before the recession to the trough of the recession, the recovery has been the worst we've had. So I think we've set our sights a little bit low. So anyway, not to say that I don't agree with you, autos have been one good spot, But I still think without a comprehensive set of policies on manufacturing, I mean, one of the things NIST was trying to do was put together a very, really great program, a $12 million program, which I'm blanking on the name of now. And
Amtech.
And the auto industry were one of the biggest supporters of it because they saw core technologies that they needed help with.
Can I take a different angle on that question as well? Because I think it goes directly to highlighting a key distinction between industrial policy and innovation policy. Bailing out GM was industrial policy. But let's look at how Germany or Japan have approached this over the past decade. All right, so in the past 10 years, Germany has invested $1.4 billion in research into advanced lithium-ion batteries, automotive electronics, lightweight composites. And they put this money into shared research consortiums between their universities and their industries to develop technologies that increase the competitiveness of their automobile manufacturing industry. Japan has invested 25 trillion yen over the past 5 years in lithium-ion batteries because they see it as, quote, an issue of national survival. So what they're doing is putting in place innovation policies to support the competitiveness of their industries. What we do is tell our companies, go off and compete as independent entities in global marketplaces against the technology-based ecosystems of other nations. And when that process fails, they come back to Washington and say, hey, it's not working, we need a bailout. So that's why we need to move from an industrial policy to a long-term innovation policy designed to enhance the competitiveness through public-private partnerships of key industries in our economy.
We've got time for one more question. Over here.
Is there a metric for measuring innovation, an action that measures innovation so that our policy makers and media can look at it and say, yes, that did something that supported the growth of innovation? Is there a metric for measuring?
No. There are metrics, and combined they can paint a picture. But we don't really have any measures of innovation itself. We're getting better at it in the National Science Foundation. But the other problem we have in the country is that is exactly one of the problems we have. Our statistical agencies do a very poor job, in part because of limited resources, of measuring innovation and the outcomes. But there's a set of measures you could put together, like high-tech employment, like the trade deficit, like a wide variety of things that could give you a picture. And but I think one of the things we need to do as a country is we need to systemically be able to better measure the innovation economy and see what kind of progress we're making. So good point.
Let me draw this to a close, and let's give a big hand to our two authors. Opportunity now for you to vent that pent-up desire to purchase that book, which is available right outside of the chat.
That was really great.